As long as
the whole show started out, we always say Katrina is the medical doctor. Yeah, like somehow it's worked in. So I was thrilled that you're here. I mean, you're here because Katrina's had surgery and you're taking care of her.
That's right.
But it's also nice to have the added benefit. We've been I think she might have mentioned to you I wanted to speak to you and or your husband for this show and just in general.
Yeah.
Now, we've mentioned on the show that Mr. Miller was OMB for Ronald Reagan.
Correct.
So he knows the deal.
Yes, he does.
And when we spoke the last time, as we were talking before the show, when he was out to this, I think it must have been 2006.
Yeah.
Right, 2 years before. Must have been around this time too, I think, or maybe not. It was when Fred Thompson was not declared, but the thought of Fred Thompson as a candidate was first floated, and I thought, wow, what a brilliant idea this guy is.
Oh, that would have been 2007.
Yes. Right. So that was when we last spoke, and I'm always impressed with your husband's ability to recite facts and figures beyond anything that you can read on in the news.
He's pretty amazing.
So so here we are. It's a new president.
Yes.
He's a Democratic president.
Yes.
Oh, I believe, I could be wrong, but you once ran for the House of Representatives.
That I did.
Right.
In the 8th District of Virginia.
All right. So we don't have just any old person off the street. We're not. This is a lot of conjecture. This
We're
show.
Lucky.
Almost always conjecture.
Uh-huh.
So we have so here we are. We have a person who's familiar with Republican politics, let's say.
That's right.
The inner workings, I would say, or how it works in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C. And we have a new president who's a Democrat. Any first impressions you want to throw out there?
Oh, it's hard to talk about first impressions because we've been sort of steeped in Obama and
right.
What he was about for the last, 10, 12 months?
At least, yeah.
Now, of course, we had heard of him before, but just barely.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he began to arise on the scene, people paid attention and we sort of looked into him. I was a little concerned about the cesspool from which he was arising. That didn't necessarily mean that he was part of that,
mm-hmm.
but that is from
what
where
we've
he
seen
came from.
since he's been elected, how bad Chicago and Illinois politics can be.
Right, and when you're my age, you remember that Chicago's been like that before. This is not anything new.
I had forgotten about it until the Black Goyevich thing happened.
Yes.
And then it was, oh, yeah, that's what they are like over there.
Yeah, yeah. Now, granted, he has to be different.
Right.
He is different, and he has to be different. And it's very exciting to have a Black president.
Right.
It's very exciting to have that. I think it solves a lot of issues for America to have
right.
crossed that Rubicon.
Yes.
And one of the old guard that dates way back, Bill Coleman, mm-hmm. Who served as Secretary of Transportation many years ago and who is African American, but he prefers to be called Black.
Mm-hmm.
We were with him at during Christmas, and he said, you know, I really hope that having this president will mean that 4 years from now, I don't have to call myself an African-American or a Black American, that
uh-huh.
people will just start talking about us as being Americans. I think maybe that was setting a little too high a standard, but
sure.
I can understand the hope.
Yeah. I was going to say I don't think it'll happen, but...
Yeah.
But it is something to aim for, absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure, sure.
I think anytime you qualify someone or something, it's a bit diminishing, so it's kind of nice to be free.
It's unfortunate not to just regard people as people,
right?
Regardless of
which seems like a simple concept, but somehow we haven't managed to get there yet.
No, but I think that I don't know seriously about deep pockets of this nation, but this seemed to be a relatively colorblind election.
I would disagree with you on that.
You think so? You think there is an inspirational, like, we can finally cross the Rubicon
type
of moment?
Yes, yes. In fact, I personally know a number of Republicans, some who served in the Reagan administration, who voted for Obama because they wanted to put their thumbprint on this part of history. They wanted to see a black man elected president.
Right.
And if they had been excited about McCain or enthusiastic about McCain, or if he had been their first love,
right,
then they might not have done it. But since he was just sort of, you know, he was the other one,
right,
and he was not that important to them,
right,
it was easy for them to make that choice. And so I do know a number of them who have done that, and they have since regretted it.
That's the real discussion right now.
Yeah, and that's, I definitely want to get into. I don't get the chance to read the details like the 1,500 page bills or the abstracts about them. But
alone, Congress didn't either.
But policy is my big thing, and that's definitely one thing I wanted to ask you about. But let's just talk about Republicans and John McCain.
John McCain has made me angry from time to time, mm-hmm. but I have tremendous admiration for him,
mm-hmm.
And the fact that he people called him a maverick, and he kind of was proud of being a maverick. I do think he was very proud of the fact that he stood on principle. He didn't always have the right principle, but most of the time he did.
Right.
And so I was very fond of him. I still am. He is truly an American hero. He wasn't just a guy who was shot down. He flew a lot of missions before he was shot down.
Right.
He really served his country. He served very well as a prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
He did have the option of coming out and didn't, because he was part of the Navy family, and he was not going to violate.
He wouldn't
their
do it
standard.
To his dad too, right? Wasn't his father secretary of something or higher a command post or something?
Both of his father and his grandfather had been high ranking Navy right. officers, and so it was deep in his bones.
Right.
But anyway, he was a good man and still is, and he is a fiscal conservative. Unfortunately, he really, when he said he didn't know that much about economics, he was right. But the difference was Obama didn't know much about economics either, and he wouldn't admit it.
Right, so, right. Well, there was the promise. Obama had this promise of a return to the last, for better or for worse. I know Republicans have their view of the Clinton presidency, but it was a boom time. It was peace and prosperity, regardless of whether he was responsible for it, however we got to it. And so Obama just, without even saying a word, represented that to a certain extent. And I think that's where he got credit for the economy without ever actually having to say much other than he would repeal the Bush tax cuts and apply it towards health care. That was really the only policy I got out of him in the run-up to the election. And I think poor John McCain, the fundamentals of the economy are sound. No one knew how they were fundamentally changed at that point, that the events were going to get farther away from, because it seemed that way. It seemed like there was a recession looming, but you know, you look at the data, there's some strength underneath this all. No one really realized what had happened, I think, in, 2 weeks in September?
Right.
So that's where he was undermined. My take on John McCain was that he was the quintessential Arizona Republican, much in the mold, not terribly in the mold of Goldwater, but in the image of Goldwater, and Ronald Reagan to a certain extent was a Western Republican, a Goldwater, an Arizona Republican. I thought that was the key. If there was anyone who's going to win after an unpopular president from the same party, in that same party, it would have been John McCain. Because
I think many Republicans shared that feeling, that he was the best hope that Republicans had given the situation and the baggage that any Republican would be carrying into that election.
Right.
But I'm not sure that anybody could have overcome that. And if there was one chance John McCain had to overcome it, it was when he came back to Washington at the moment of crisis.
Yes.
If he had said, hell no.
On the bailout?
Yes. If he had said hell no to the bailout, that would have been his one chance.
Right.
But I'm not even sure that would have worked, because even saying hell no at that point, the economy was still going to go down some from that point on.
Sure.
And there was going to be still the feeling that, oh, well, if he had done something, if he had not said no, that we would have been okay. So I think he really didn't. It was very hard to say that he had a chance at all.
Right. Is there someone? I mean, I always thought it was Mitt Romney. And I still think, outside of Sarah Palin for 2012, it's Mitt Romney's. And I know he has... He's come. They branded him Slick Willie to a certain extent on the Republican side, but he's a fiscal. He's a successful businessman.
Yes, he is very successful.
And he comes from. He was successful in Massachusetts, so knowing that you have the basic South to you know, the Republicans are going to most always win the South and parts of the Southwest. And coming from Massachusetts is a good. Point for, you know, Mitt Romney, or well, I guess he's had like a couple of hometowns to be in.
That's right. He can still claim Michigan.
He can claim Michigan too. So I always thought it was him, or he would have been the running mate for John McCain. At that moment, I thought that if he had chosen Mitt Romney, it would have sent an economic message to the populace.
I just don't know. I actually think Sarah Palin was probably the best that John McCain could have done. I think she did what no one else could have done, and that was she rallied the Republican women. And as it was, Republican women were not excited about the ticket until Sarah Palin was on there.
Really?
And I was in a room with 400 other Republicans moments before that was announced, and we got word that it was going to be Sarah Palin. And literally, the women in the room stood up and cheered. And the people who were carrying on the program up front wondered what in the world was going on, and that's what it was about.
Right.
Without Sarah Palin, he probably would have done much worse. I realized that an awful lot of people, particularly the elites in Washington, were just horrified and poked fun at her. And the Democrats felt that she was a strength for them, but I don't think so. I think she helped John McCain.
I would agree, especially in the beginning. You know, as someone who is, I have to admit, I was like going to vote Democrat no matter what. There's no question in my mind. I was actually a Hillary supporter, and, you know, hope, you know, hope my standing hasn't diminished too much.
No, that's not a problem.
At first I thought this is the pick that's going to, at first I thought, doesn't make any sense. And then I thought, as I saw her gain some momentum, I thought, all right, this is the one that's going to put him over the top. Coming out of the Republican convention, he was in the lead.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, we probably had the best Democratic convention you could have. So it was pretty big for McCain to come out in the lead. I feel like if Sarah Palin had, I don't know, performed better in interviews, she was amazing on the stump.
Mm-hmm.
But getting, and people say they were gotcha questions, but when she got tripped up by Katie Kirk, that, I mean, that's a kind of a easier. She didn't go on Charlie Rose. She didn't go on MSNBC. You know, she didn't go into the lion's den, or, you know, go up against someone who's going to ask her detailed policy. She fumbled on Katie Couric.
I think she could have done even better if she had gone into some of those lion's dens. And I also think she would have done better if she hadn't had any of John McCain's people around her advising her.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. I think that they really, really mismanaged her. And she was trying to be a good soldier, and she regrets it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Have you ever met her? Or?
Yes, I have. I had actually met her about a year ago and was very impressed with her. She was in Washington giving a speech on energy policy because
right.
she is something of an expert on energy policy.
Right.
And she was quite impressive. She took questions from the audience without any difficulty at all.
Right.
And it was a Washington crowd, so it was not a bunch of know-nothings.
Right.
And she did quite well. So I was very impressed with her then.
I think she's the nominee in 2012.
Well, maybe. We'll see. I do think you've got something about Mitt Romney. He did have some detractors, but he is a turnaround artist. He has done some turnarounds that have been quite impressive.
Right.
And he certainly knows far more about economics than either Obama or McCain.
Right.
And in fact, he knows more about economics than just about anybody in the White House right now. So,
which
it's
gets
possible.
Us onto our policy discussion.
But you know, knowing a lot about something isn't necessarily what helps you win either a nomination or an election.
Right.
There's a lot more to it. So.
Well, from the Democratic side, it was nice to see a campaign flip all the right switches on our side.
Absolutely.
Have one clear message. Not, you know, we haven't seen that since 92 and 96. And we did see it in 2000 and 2004. You know, the people, and like you said, you don't need to know something to be all that, to win the campaign.
Yeah.
Because the people around, I think the people who managed George Bush's campaign, the people who managed Bill Clinton's campaign, they were evolutionary. They took, the Bush people took what Clinton had, and those guys had established in really 92.
Yeah.
And perfected it in 2000 and 2004. And then the Obama people just added some more stuff to it, some more internet stuff that wasn't necessarily being exploited in 2004, and had that singular focus, which was rewarding. I remember looking at John Kerry in dismay that there was no one theme.
Yeah. Mm.
And even when I was a Hillary supporter in the primary, she had a different placard behind her every time she won or did a concession speech on a primary. And, you know, there's these change we can believe in signs behind Obama every time.
Did you find that surprising about Hillary, given what had the people who had run Bill Clinton's mm-hmm. campaign?
Yes.
It was surprising.
I did.
Yeah.
I found it very surprising.
I was shocked.
Yeah.
I was absolutely shocked. I also thought that Mark Penn had positioned her to win 2004 and not 2008.
Right.
So.
And the world has changed quite a bit.
The world had changed dramatically.
Yeah.
I also do think that it might have been a photo finish had it not been for the what seems to be utter financial collapse of the investment banking system in the United mm-hmm. States. Had that not happened, you could have seen McCain fight it out to the end. But once that happened, it just seemed like everyone in the country decided to vote. If A is Republican, they were voting B.
It was a perfect storm.
Yeah.
It really was a perfect storm. And we're not out of it yet.
Yeah, that was my point. Now that we're in it, let's talk about what's happening in the White House.
Well,
and why we're alarmed.
This is when I don't know if we were on the air when we said there are times when Steve and I have agreed with the criticisms from the Republican Party, or even just in general. I personally can't understand exactly what they're doing.
I think I can, and it scares the living daylights out of me.
Okay.
If I thought they were trying to solve our economic crisis, I would just be disappointed that they were the gang that couldn't shoot straight. But I don't think that's what they're trying to do. Remember what Rahm Emanuel said about a crisis? Never let a crisis go to waste. And what he meant was, use a crisis to forward your real agenda. And that's what scares me. I think they are using the crisis. They're not really trying to solve the crisis. You cannot solve a recession with borrowing and spending.
Right.
And they know that. They have to know that.
Well, there are a couple of questions I have for you on that. One is, that's the anecdotal evidence of, we didn't really get out of the Depression until World War II.
Mm, yes.
And that was a massive military war effort that was done on, I believe it was Keynesian economics at the time. I'm not sure. They don't call it John Maynard Keynes economic now, but the whole notion that you borrow when you deficit spend to stimulate the economy on a macro level.
Actually, what the Keynesian economics played a part in the Hoover administration and in the earlier parts of the FDR administration. Hoover tried to spend and regulate his way out of a recession, and he turned it into a depression. And then FDR came in, and his people said, you know what, we just didn't spend and regulate enough. And so they were Hoover on steroids. And so the depression went on and on and on. And that's where I pointed out that you don't have to be right to be elected, because he had a marvelous charisma, and he was a tremendous leader, and he did produce all of these government programs, and so just the very activity of making it seem like he was getting something done, people elected him again and again, and they were enthralled with him, in spite of the fact that when he was elected for his third term, the unemployment was still,
was it like at least 17% at that point?
Incredible.
Nearly 20%.
Yeah.
And so what they were doing was all wrong. But in the build-up to World War II, the very beginning that helped America was not America going into debt spending on war material. It was foreign countries buying war material from the United States. And that was just the beginning. Now, of course, they also ran out of money. Remember, England ran out of money, and FDR came up with, and this was one of his better ideas, Lend-Lease. I'm not sure he personally came up with it, but he certainly made it work.
Yeah.
Lend-Lease, where we were lending. We weren't borrowing at that point. We were lending to England that had no money.
Right.
So they could have war material from us. And who was going to make the war material? American private businesses.
Right.
So that's what started getting us out. But there were some other touch-and-go places. There were some really difficult times, not just during the war, but after the war, too, when we had all of this military-industrial buildup, and we had to turn it into a domestic economy.
Right.
So that was challenging, too, and quite frankly, Truman didn't do too bad a job with that. Neither did Eisenhower.
Right. Well, yeah, Eisenhower is just it seemed like he had such a sort of a middle-of-the-road political philosophy that he doesn't necessarily, you know what I mean? He's not associated with a movement or,
right.
you know, an era. I mean, other than the boom and peace of the 50s.
He's right. He's occasionally quoted for things right. like he talked about the danger of the military-industrial
conflict. The number one quote.
He used that
exactly.
over and over. And I'm not sure that they really translate what he was trying to say at the time. But probably one of the most important things he did, and others have tried to copy this, but they don't have the fundamental concept. He was concerned about, he remembered what war was like on the continent of Europe. And he felt that the European countries could have defended themselves better if they had been better prepared. And part of that would have been if they had been able to move their armies around for defensive purposes.
Right.
And he said, you know, we need to be able to move armies and materiel within the United States, and we don't have a highway system that supports it. And he started the interstate highway system.
Right.
And, of course, it's never complete, but it wasn't really going until long after he was gone.
Right.
But that is probably a more important thing that he did that sometimes he gets credit for.
Yeah, I think he does. I associate the interstate commerce system
definitely.
With him. I associate Truman with not using the bomb a second or third time. That's what most historians give him credit for, was that when
he did
people,
use it a second time.
Well, he did.
But
he did.
We didn't have a third bomb.
Yeah.
There's no telling what he might have done if we had a third bomb.
No, but I think during Korea, right? I forgot where it was, but people were saying use it.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, after I've seen what it can do, I'm going
exactly.
to say let's not do that. That's what historians cite
he
him
as a great president. He was sufficiently horrified.
Yes.
Yeah. And he was vilified for getting involved in Korea.
Right.
And people forget that we lost 50,000 people in Korea, too.
Yeah.
So it was not a minor thing.
The Korean War is always overlooked when it comes to body counts and significance. And
well, because our news media coverage was very different. That was before you had news coming back immediately about losses.
Right.
Once we had that in Vietnam, it made a huge difference.
Well, I think that the one thing the military learned a lesson about was how to manage the message. We've never seen a war like Vietnam.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think we ever will. There's a great, I say it every time on the show, there's a great documentary from the, I think, 1979 called The Televised History of Vietnam. And it's definitely got an agenda, but what's fascinating is how much footage they were able to dig up.
Mm-hmm.
There were cameras everywhere.
Yes.
There were cameras in battles.
Yes.
In
the footage is on television every night.
Yes.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
To have a war spilling into your living room was really...
It will never be seen. Like the closest we got was we saw the cameras on the missiles in Gulf War I.
Right. Yeah. But those, you see, were much less personal. In the Vietnamese films, we saw bodies being tossed into piles or lifted in great hammocks up into helicopters. You didn't see that ever again.
Yeah.
Because that was just too much to take. It's so much less personal to see a bomb going into a building,
yeah,
and you don't actually see the flesh.
Right, right. That's true. All right, so let's do, I mean, where would you like to take the policy questions?
Well, I'm just curious on your take, I mean, your specific take on what's going on in or what's emerging from the White House right now, these solutions that are being put forth. I mean, you've mentioned the spending as not being something that makes sense, and I agree. I'm really curious to know what you think would make sense.
There have been some voices of sanity. What the Democrats proposed was all this spending, and there were alternatives that were suggested by Republicans. Both there was a Republican alternative in the House and in the Senate, and I don't remember much news coverage of either one of them, but both of them were genuinely targeted to stimulating business activity, because the only thing that makes jobs for American people is business activity in America.
Right.
And these were suggesting incentives for businesses to start up, businesses to expand, businesses to hire more people and produce more products. And that is really the only thing that's going to work. Just spending a whole lot of money on, especially a lot of these government programs are going to go right into the very sectors of the economy that are suffering the least right now. Quite frankly, as much as we're personally concerned about our health insurance and being able to pay for health care, the health care industry is not the industry that is suffering the most right now. They are still going pretty much gangbusters. Another is education. While we might be personally concerned about paying for our children's college education, the educational institutions are the ones that are not suffering right now that much, especially public education. The public schools are still getting paid. The teachers are getting paid. You're still having more money in that sector than in, say, the manufacturing sector. And in the other thing is government. These programs that they have proposed are going to produce tremendous number of government jobs. But we already have a lot of government jobs. Remember, government never has a dime to spend that it doesn't take from taxpayers. One way or another, it takes it from taxpayers. So we really need to stimulate those kinds of activities. With the auto industry, there are a lot of theories about why the Detroit Big Three are suffering, and one of them certainly is their labor costs. They have to get that under control. Another is, frankly, a lot of the regulations that they have struggled under. Those need to be adjusted so that they can deal with them better. But the best thing that could have happened to them would have been bankruptcy, because they can't make those changes without bankruptcy.
The market always instructs. I mean, that's what we were talking about before. Yeah. It's like, if something's wrong, you're being taught in the bottom line. It's very, very clear.
You're not making the product, or you're not making a profit.
The product or the way you're running your business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Anytime you subsidize failure, what do you get?
More failure. And a higher price tag for it.
The big fear that they have, and I think there's some anecdotal evidence when General Motors shut down Oldsmobile, is that a bankrupt car company won't sell cars. People won't buy them. And I think that happened with General Motors. When they shut down Oldsmobile, they were just, I remember them giving them away, because people, even though the monolith, you know, this giant General, at that point was still healthy, giant company was around, had been around for years, was going to stand behind the cars. No one wanted the brand.
Right.
So that's their big fear.
Well, if government wants to help with that, why don't they address that issue? They could have provided a system of guaranteeing parts, service, something like that for the auto industries. Perhaps it would have been a modified bankruptcy,
right,
but they would still have all the advantages of bankruptcy that would allow them to readjust all of their debts and their obligations.
It's the three areas, right? Bankruptcy allows them to address bondholders, labor costs, and legacy costs, correct?
Yes.
And that's where they're hamstrung now.
Actually, in bankruptcy, they would probably be able to deal with some of their other debts that they have. Invariably, when companies are going into bankruptcy, they've started getting slower and slower paying their vendors.
Oh, right.
And all of those that are providing for them. So they've got those debts, too, to worry about. And, of course, the vendors were standing up and saying, we don't want them to go bankrupt because they knew what was going to happen if they did.
Yeah, they would lose their, they'd have to settle for cents on the dollar.
In the long run, in the short run, it would have been more painful, but in the long run, it would have been less so. As it is, we may have dumped money into General Motors. We'll never get back because General Motors may still go bankrupt.
Oh, I'm sure. And now the money we've given them, it will be under bankruptcy.
It's going to go away with
precisely.
And then let's talk about the whole banking meltdown. I mean, and the bailout of AIG. I mean, what do you think about this?
Well, AIG is an insurer.
Yes.
And it really is enormous. And there had to be some kind of accommodation for AIG. And it is true that we were facing a credit crisis in the fall. As you mentioned in the very beginning, you mentioned my husband, Jim. His estimation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was that both were solvent, but there were cash flow issues. And with a lot of these banks and other financial institutions, many of their problems could have been mitigated if the mark-to-market rule had changed. You know, that's one that has changed over the last century. It has been changed a number of times. And what mark-to-market does is, if there's no market, how do you value something?
Right.
And the mark-to-market would force you to zero out something that you could not value just because there was no market for it right then. But it might actually be a valuable asset if you could just hold on to it for a while. But if you mark-to-market and zero it out, then you look like you are
insolvent
when you're not. And if they go back to what we call mark-to-value, instead of mark to market, many of these financial institutions would have been in far better shape.
Well, this is, I agree with you, but my problem with that is, if you just take Los Angeles, forget the rest of the country, I know it's extremely one-sided to do that, and you just take a bad asset in the form of a mortgage in Los Angeles. Someone paid, and I know the house, I can drive you by it, someone paid close to $1 million for a 1,050 square foot house on a corner with the smallest piece of land, because on the corner in the Fairfax district, they etched out the space between the two corner houses to put a third house. It has the shallowest property. It's exposed on two sides. It's on the flats. It's not even in the hills. It sold for $1 million.
And this was when?
About 2005. That property, I'm hoping, has dropped to at least $650, and in given the current state of affairs, it should really sell for $450. Ideally, some of us like to see it sell for about $300. You would have to sit on that house. Now, taking all the extraordinary means, like the extraordinary circumstances out, the rule of thumb I've always, these are like all the rules of thumbs I know about finance. If you're earning 10%, your money doubles in 7 years. If you're earning 7%, it doubles in 10 years, if you're lucky, if you're with the market trend. And it's 7 years from top to bottom in a real estate market. So they would have to hold on to that $330,000 house, or $450,000 or $600,000 house, 7 years to make that other money back.
What you're saying is a series of people made a very bad decision.
Mm-hmm.
And bad decisions should not be rewarded.
Well, then that would mark to market down to zero or $300,000.
No, it wouldn't be. It would mark to value, not to market.
Okay.
It wouldn't mark it to zero, but would mark it down to the $300,000.
Okay.
Because quite frankly, if you did offer it at $300,000, it could be
it
sold.
It would snap.
Yeah.
It would be
and,
gone.
And
I would buy it.
That's true of a lot of properties. What has the Flim Flam man said, that you can't cheat an honest person? That there are people who were trying to make a killing in the real estate market and got overexcited, they are going to be losing a lot of money and probably deserve to. And quite frankly, the banks that foolishly backed them are going to lose a lot of money and deserve to. And yes, the housing bubble is a painful thing to get over. And there were a lot of things that went into it, including changes that allowed them securitization of bundles of bad loans. Very bad idea. You can thank Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac for some of that. And you can thank Chris Dodd.
I know. There was a Democrat. The notion that I don't know if...
It's hard to get away from
that. I don't want to speak for Senator Dodd or for Bill Clinton, but I think the notion was if you could inject capital market forces into the lower end of the credit zone, not in the way it wound up happening, but if you could go to an area where the home values are depressed and the people don't have good credit and provide a way for them to buy homes in their own community, you might see those communities perk up. That was the notion.
That was the notion.
It turned into the subprime mortgage crisis.
Right, right.
In my heart, I agree with that, but I also would always say to myself, how can you keep someone from not taking that credit card offer in the mail?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I understand. And that... a lot of people, especially those who have the least,
want to do it.
Are going to be falling for that kind of thing. You know that idea of allowing people with virtually no assets to buy homes was not a new one in the Clinton administration. It had started long before with the Community Reinvestment Act.
Oh, wow.
That goes way back into, it goes back to the late 70s, but it didn't have teeth until the Clinton administration. Now, we can't hang all of that around Clinton's neck because he didn't write the original law. It had nothing to do with it. What, he was 14 years old or something when that was done. But that act got teeth in the Clinton administration.
Right.
And people who should have known better, who were making millions making decisions, allowed that not only to happen, but then when they could see the results that these were going bad, they said, well, all we have to do is bundle these up with some good loans, and then we can sell them as... And that's right. Where it got
now we've
bad.
Exported this thing globally now.
Yeah.
You know,
it didn't happen just in the United States.
Right.
It went, the whole idea caught fire around the world, and other countries did it. And Europe is suffering from the same kind of thing. And which that makes everybody else suffer because now the Chinese are suffering because we're not buying as many of their products.
Right.
And we need the Chinese right now.
And we need them to fund our expansion of government spending.
That's it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. My question to you is I've been grasping at what is actually going on. And I've been in the dark, and I've tried my hardest to figure things out. And in the last week or two, it's all kind of come together for me. Started with last week, I think, where I was like, either bail it all out or let it go to ashes. Just tell me which way we're going, you know? Because I'm going to have to find a job if it goes to ashes. I know that. And I may have to because the middle of this, I don't know what we're doing, path isn't really reaping rewards. And after reading some stuff and listening to some informed reporting, it turns out that there's $2.75 to $4 or $5 trillion worth of damage done to, you know, the financial system. There's a hole there.
Yeah.
And I guess that's if you go to zero. I guess if you say there are $2.75 to $5 trillion worth of marked to zero, but I could be wrong. Let's just say that's the number.
Your guess is probably as good as anybody's.
Yeah. So that hole is in the system right now, and you either go one of two paths. You either stabilize it, pump money into it, support those bad assets, either buy them or hold them or provide the cash flow for people who are holding banks that are holding them to keep doing business, you know, or you let it go down and you deal with the ramifications of a crisis of confidence, banking institutions failing, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't think the public is really quite aware of that. I think they think that somehow we're gonna pull out of this without they're fully against bailing out the auto industry. They're fully against. They didn't like $700 billion. They're not gonna like $4 trillion. You know, we've said it, you know, the car companies didn't you know, they poor products, bad management, they're getting their rewards. But then they scare you with 3 million people maybe out of work. And my whole existence is based around basically restoring movies that will either be put on television or being sold through DVD. If I'm thinking 3 million people lose their job in this country, that impulse purchase at the register of a DVD is not going to happen, and it's going to come right back to me. Mm-hmm. So I'm just, where I'm coming from is, are we going to do one or the other? Because right now I don't see the point of the spending that I've heard proposed. I don't see the point in the mortgage bailout that I've heard proposed. The thing that I thought was the greatest was there was a chance they were going to do a $15,000, up to $15,000 tax credit if you put 20% down on a house, and the possibility of Fannie and Freddie backed 4 or 4.5% loans for people who do put 20% down. Like, that to me was perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
people will
get
into the market very quickly.
Yeah, you are really talking like a Reagan Republican.
I know it's scary what's happening.
The idea is, what you're saying is that giving people incentives to do the right thing, to make sensible purchases, purchasing a house with 20% down, that kind of thing, giving them the right incentives would improve the economy, and it would. But you were saying you were beginning to get your arms around it. I do not know any economist who has their arms completely around this situation. They can look back and see where mistakes were made, and they can point out some serious mistakes that are being made now, mm-hmm. and they can have some suggestions of what might help. But the one thing that will pull us out of this, if we don't drive ourselves into debt that is beyond management, which is what we're close to doing, is what John McCain was talking about, the fundamentals of the economy being the ingenuity and energy and work ethic right. of the American public. That is the one thing that is likely to ultimately save us. Now, there's lots of blame to go around. We talked about the Community Reinvestment Act. That was not the only thing. We did have a loose money policy for too long. There were times when our interest rates were jacked up a little too high, but instead of easing down a little bit, they just plunge them down right. to next to nothing.
Right.
This driving like a race car driver, full gas or full brake, is not the way to manage the economy. You need a stable money supply. You need stable policies that don't swing wildly one way to the other. All of this excessive spending, as I said, scares the living daylights out of me, because we are building up a debt that potentially will carry on into your children's and grandchildren's lives.
Oh, yeah.
And it is just so enormous, people can't even imagine that they're using numbers like, well, if you spend $1 million a day from the day that Jesus was born until today,
you still wouldn't
spend as much as this latest bill. And some of these things are obligations that go on forever. They don't go away after
right.
10 years.
Right.
So we really need to let our government know that we want the profligate spending to stop. There are even a couple of Democrats now
that are
opposing. Evan Bayh has mm-hmm. come out against it. Russ Feingold has come out against it. I'm glad to see them do it. I wish that the
Russ Feingold came out against it.
Yes, he even said if this passes, if this latest $410 billion passes, that the president should veto it.
Yeah. I'm against it. I didn't even know that there was an omnibus spending bill that wasn't handled before Bush left office. I didn't know that there was something.
Do you know why it wasn't?
Because he wouldn't sign it, right?
That's right. He wouldn't sign it, and the Democrats said, well, we'll just fund the bill. We'll just fund 6 months, and that way, when we have a Democrat president and we have complete control,
right.
then we can pass whatever we want. And that's what they're doing.
In the realm of partisan, I'm willing to accept we're going to spend X number of dollars. Republicans would spend it this way, and we're going to spend it that way.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with you're really upset about your priorities being neglected. That's what happens when we're in the minority, especially in the House. But the whole notion of it's a wish list that of what, I grew up in under Reagan, and slowly moved to the left. I'm the opposite of Churchill. Churchill said, I think, in paraphrasing, if you're a liberal, if you're not a liberal when you're 20, you're heartless, and if you're not a conservative when you're 30, you're mindless. I'm exactly the paradigm of that. I'm
mindless. I think he said 40, so maybe you're okay.
I gotcha.
You're on track.
There's still time.
But I've always admired or the policy. Like Clinton always had a policy that he said would do something, and then OMB would mark it, and then CBO would mark it. And it would basically fit what they said they were going to spend. It would basically fit what they said would come in revenue. It almost always, within the realm.
Right.
Even when the Republicans control Congress, which I think CBO is supposed to be independent, but you could even say even then it was always scored pretty much close to what he said.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that happening now.
Yeah. There are other things that have happened. Clinton had an advantage. He had an advantage after Republicans took the House in 94 because they had a leader at the time, mm-hmm. Newt Gingrich, who really was a fiscal conservative and who really did hold down the spending. Now, he did. He's a guy that just spouts new ideas like a fountain.
Mm-hmm.
And he did get carried away, and he made mistakes, and that cost him his position. Then the Republicans, with their Congress, lost their way, and they started spending like Democrats used to spend.
Like Great Society Democrats.
Exactly. And not just on good ideas. They were spending on good ideas and bad ideas, mm-hmm. and they spent money. I won't say like drunken sailors because that would insult drunken sailors. They were just, it was just outrageous. And so, quite frankly, when they were thrown out in 2006, they should have been.
Right.
They deserved it.
Right.
And fiscal conservatives, Reagan conservatives, people like me, said, a pox on both your houses.
Right.
We were fed up with the spending, and quite frankly, we were angry. There were many things that Bush did that we liked, but we were angry with President Bush because he did not wield the veto pen when he should have,
right.
and he did let Congress carry on profligate spending that was just not defensible. Now, we've got, for the last 2 years, we've had Congress has been controlled, the House has been controlled by the Democrats. And the Senate has been controlled by the Democrats, but we had a larger group.
We only had a one-seat majority in the Senate.
We had enough that we could filibuster if we had to.
Mm-hmm.
But still, the Republicans, so many of the Republicans were still that profligate spending group.
Mm-hmm.
And so they weren't doing the job that conservative Republicans wanted them to do.
Right.
And they weren't doing what was responsible for the country. Now we have a bunch of Democrats who have 20 years of pent-up demand, and they feel that this is their opportunity. While we have a crisis, use the crisis, as Rahm Emanuel said, use it
mm-hmm.
to get this pent-up demand out. Well, this is the one thing you cannot afford when you are in a recession. You cannot afford deficits, you cannot afford to have excessive spending, and you cannot afford to raise taxes.
Right.
And they're going to do both.
They are. I must admit, as a liberal, I don't mind the raising of income taxes on people making $250,000 a year or more.
And that supposedly is not going to occur for two more years anyway.
Anyway. My big thing is, let's take what's been going throughout, which basically has been confirmed, like our dismay has been confirmed tonight. What would the... Let's take, because I agree with you on Newt Gingrich, his fiscal conservatism was pure. He was the last direct line to Ronald Reagan, as far as I could see in the party. He was a backbencher, I think, when Reagan came into office and fought his way up to the top and led the revolution.
And he seems to be reemerging now.
He is.
Yeah.
I've always been afraid of him because if you listen to his ideas, he could win. You know, he and then you will have a serious conservative presidency, like it or hate it. And it would be a dream for conservatives, but for any activist liberal, it would be a nightmare. But, you know, I've heard him. One of his most genius statements was he fused Bush's spending with Obama's. He just said over the weekend at CPAC that we have this, I think he said this grand irony of the Bush-Obama, Obama-Bush spending.
Right.
I completely...
I like this idea about the tax holiday.
Actually, that was one of the good...
I thought it was really interesting.
That was a great
idea. That's a great way to keep money that we have in people's hands instead of borrowing it.
And when you think about it, if instead of that $1 trillion stimulus package, if they had taken a tax holiday for 1 year, it wouldn't have cost any more.
Anything.
It would not have cost any more. It would not have been, and it would not have increased our debt.
Exactly,
nearly
which is
as
the
much.
Point.
Right.
That's the point.
So that would have been excellent.
That's stimulation for businesses. That's stimulation for individuals as well.
It's also, I'm hearing so much about numbers, and then I'm hearing about the crisis of faith in the market, of belief in the market, the mindset. The one thing you said that FDR had charisma, and one thing he instilled in people was a belief. Clinton too, Reagan too. I mean, if you look at the hallmarks of the presidents, you know, that have had major impacts. Even as much as I disliked George W. Bush as a president, he did have a certain amount of inspiring the American people in what we identify ourselves in. And you're not hearing that right now. And I think a tax holiday for a year would make people extraordinarily... You just feel like, all right, well, at least I have this.
Well, I mean, my God, if I got to keep all that extra money...
You'd be smiling.
I'd be smiling now.
I'd change the whole thing.
Which is the thing that's scaring me. But let me just ask you, in a perfect world, would Newt Gingrich say the market must correct? We'll change it from mark to market to mark to value, and we'll do some government rebates for positive, targeted relief for positive spending, and let the market just crash? Would he not bail out? Like, would I mean, I know AIG, when I finally found out what they did, of course we have to bail them out. They're around the world.
They're around the world.
They go down
the
so many other people.
The problem.
And they took the bet. They insured the credit default swaps. Yeah. Like they bet big. So I get we have to. But would he say no? AIG, General Motors, Ford. When you're done with your financing, Chrysler, you're all gone.
Yeah, I don't know what he would say if he were. I really don't know.
What about the theoretical conservative ideal? What would that say to the current
situation? The theoretical conservative ideal would be a mixture of changes in tax policy that would instill confidence and courage in businesses. Modifications of some regulations, such as the mark-to-market and some others. That's only one. That's the one that's most obvious, but
right.
There are others.
Mm-hmm.
Combined with methods of lending to institutions where necessary to keep certain market flows working, because you're trying to correct something that government created.
Right. Or allowed to create.
Partly created and allowed to create.
I have to get semantic on you.
Yeah. A little bit of both.
People have to take some responsibility for their actions.
There would be some of both. But I do think that talking it down, talking the economy down, is very damaging.
Right.
I understand why Obama was doing it. And I think he was doing it quite intentionally. He was trying to create a sense of horrible crisis so that he could get these things passed, which were very big pills for a lot of members of Congress to swallow. But he did exactly the opposite of what FDR did in that one instant. Everything else he's done is the same thing that FDR did. But FDR said, you have nothing to fear, but we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Obama says crisis or catastrophe 35 times in a 3-minute speech.
Right.
Yeah.
And the difference is not negligible. It really matters, the kind of confidence the president instills.
Right.
And people are not having a lot of confidence in... I just saw a poll today, and they asked, how many of you believe that Obama's policies are going to pull us out of this recession? 95% said either no or I don't know.
Right.
5% said yes. That's not confidence.
Well, you know, we talked about it last week. The dog whistle of the stock market is what we're looking for.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that Bill Clinton had for him was once, again, hate it or love it, once that Al Gore cast that 51st vote for his economic policy, the markets responded and said there's a lot of things we don't like in here, but essentially if it works, it sends us on this trajectory towards reducing, not going to balance, but reducing the percentage of GDP that the annual deficit is. And in kind, you could see that they were responding. And so we're all, and now I think the percentage of people who were in the market in 1992 was much less in the stock market than it is now.
Yeah.
And so people started to look at that and listen and look for that sign, you know, or that crazy economist when you're hurting and he goes, you know, this isn't so bad. The fundamentals of the economy is fine and I see, you know, we'll be pulling out next year at this time. We're all waiting to hear that.
Yeah.
And it's not emerging.
Mm-mm.
And I lost my hair when the market went to 71. If it went up today, I think it was 3% of a diminished number.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's
the fear I have is it dust? Is 14,000 to 6,700 dust?
Well, I actually heard one predictor who said, this was back in October, who said the market was going to go down to 6,000 and then would start slowly back. And I thought, oh, not really. It won't go that low. Well, it hasn't gone to 6,000, but it's gone close.
Right.
I don't know when we're going to reach that turnaround, but the stock market does matter.
Right.
It does matter. And people have lost a real value. This is not imaginary. Everyone has lost at least 30% of his wealth. And some people think, oh, I don't have any wealth. Mm-hmm. But if you own anything, you have some wealth.
Right.
If you own a home, if you own a car, anything that you own, you have lost wealth
in this
market. And we have to hope that it is, that some of these predictors are right. But so far, there's no confidence in what the Obama administration has done. And every time he opens his mouth, the market drops again. So maybe.
But they love him. He's still polling really high. His policies
pull
low and he polls really high.
Well, he is elegant. He is eloquent. And he has an inspiring quality about him.
Mm-hmm.
People just don't think he knows what to do about the economic situation. And so far they haven't seen him do anything about it that they think is going to work.
I think people are willing to give him the benefit of the doubt because, like you said, economists haven't gotten their head around it. And honestly, I dove headfirst into as many things as I could to find out what's going on.
We emerged even more confused. But.
Yeah. But I think if someone's like, I can't figure out how this is going to change either, I don't blame the guy for trying something that I can tell man on the street isn't going to work. Like I don't fault him for it. They can say 95% can say, I don't know if it's going to work or I don't think it'll work.
The problem is I don't want to hear my president saying that, even if it's true.
Well, the president's not saying that. He firmly believes that what he's doing is saying that he firmly believes.
He says he believes that what he's doing is going to solve the economic crisis. I think what he really believes is that what he's doing is going to create the change that he wanted to create. And I think it will.
I have news for him. No one wanted that. The change that we were talking about was we'll take Clinton-style democracy. We'll take accommodations with the right, basically sound government, pay-go. We'll go for that. We're not. I'm not for the expansion of government that he thinks he was elected.
Well, I'm going to put on my professional psychologist hat now and say that he is engaging in misattribution. He keeps talking about we were elected to make these changes,
mm-hmm.
and he is mistaken. That is not why he was elected. Some of his popularity is a matter of the triumph of hope
yes.
over experience.
Mm-hmm.
he was elected for a lot of reasons, but to make these kinds of changes and to make a huge expansive government was not one of them.
Yeah, I think I'm hoping that he gets the backlash before the midterms.
Well, I hope he gets the message and changes his behavior.
That's true. Well, but there's another theory that was floated, which is the stress test on the bank is really just a cover to figure out how many they're going to nationalize in one weekend.
Yeah, and that just having that rumor going around is very damaging. Really damaging.
We've seen the results of that very quickly.
Yeah. But they think that that's... Because he said there are multiple legs to the stool.
Yeah.
Mortgages and stimulus and addressing the banking industry. And from what I understand, if you value these banks based on their stocks and without the changes in the accounting or whatever the practice is, they're all insolvent.
Not all of them. There are actually a few that are not. There are particularly small banks.
Small ones.
Big banks are suffering.
But all
much
the big
more.
Ones.
But many.
But like
of
Wells Fargo, Bank of America,
right.
Citi are all headed for nationalization. And the reality is, if you do Bank of America, and this I'm paraphrasing straight from This American Life, if you do Citibank, you have to do Bank of America, you have to do Wells Fargo, you have to do a bunch of them.
Yeah.
And you can't. Like you said, that rumor is just doing damage.
Exactly.
They said you can't communicate it, you can't signal it. So what happens is that on a Friday they announce they're nationalizing the banks at the close of business, and then over the weekend they take them over.
Until that rumor goes away, the market is not turning around.
Is there ever an instance where you could see a conservative nationalizing a bank? I mean, one happened under Reagan, right? There was a big, I don't know if it was a bank or a big...
It was the savings and loan crisis.
No, but wasn't there one giant one that was done in the mid-80s? There was one...
I
know savings and loan happened at the end, and I wonder how much that is adjusted for inflation, because it was $150 billion in 1988, 1989.
Yeah.
So, we weren't talking in trillions in those days, thank God.
Yeah.
all right, we're almost out of time. I feel like I've monopolized the whole conversation.
No, it's been great. I've loved it.
I would love maybe. Are you going to be around next week?
Or I will be here through next Wednesday.
Maybe we could do one more.
Oh, that'd be fun.
One more show.
That would be fun. I really wish my husband Jim could be here, because
next
he
time he's
really
in town.
Has got a much more solid feel about this. He really has been.
I remember just a few things. You know, when you speak about these broad strokes you read about in Time magazine, and then you talk to Katrina's dad.
There's a world of difference.
You don't even know. Yeah. You don't even know what's going on. Mm-hmm. He knows. He knows where the money's going to go and what its relative effectiveness or waste is going to be. Is he still being called to testify before Congress on matters of financial importance?
Actually, yes. They were trying to get him to testify about something recently, but he is not involved in the financial issues of the government right now. He does have a government position, and it's just a part-time one, and it was one that he never thought he would agree to take, but he is still on the board of governors of the U.S. Postal Service, and the U.S. Postal Service is suffering serious problems right now, some of which are related to the economy, some of which are related to the fact that we have some very bad legislation that limits the Postal Service and some of the things that it can do, and that's because you have members of Congress who control these decisions, who are really only interested in the entities in their state. Like if they have a big mass mailer in their state,
right.
They want to adjust the policies just so that they will fit that, and that has cost the Postal Service. Everybody loves the Postal Service. Mm-hmm. It's very important to us. We're willing to make some compromises, but we would like to see the Postal Service freed to act like a business.
I would think that the Postal Service would be the number one supply and demand business in the country. If there are X number, if mail is diminishing because of modern communication, then you need less of it.
Yep.
And if e-commerce is driving up package shipping through the Postal Service, then you need more of that particular service. To me, it would just be a no-brainer.
Sure. Yes.
Obviously not.
There are a lot of things that are no-brainers, but the Postal Service operates under regulations that UPS and FedEx and all those others don't.
Of course. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's been a delight. I really, really appreciate it.
I've had a good time, too.
And I don't know if you've ever heard the show, but when Katrina's on, everyone loves that Katrina. We always stumble onto something where she can speak about the medical industry. So it's nice to have Mom on to speak about politics.
It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's been great.
Yeah. And so, of course, I don't know how to shut everything. Oh, there we go. I will. I think I just click off. Katrina's always here for this part.
Say goodnight to all.
Oh, yeah. Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening. This has been Is Good Radio.
We'll talk to you again soon.
What's left. And, yes, we'll talk to you next week. Okay. Thank you so much.
That was great.
It was fun. It really was fun.
My big thing is, though, are we ready as a nation to go through this transformation? This is not 1930. This is not a nation of immigrants that are used to taking cement sacks and turning them into quilts. This is a different country.
Well, were you ready for adolescence? You don't have a choice.
This is the problem, right? We'll do it.